The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
Good morning and welcome to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting from the University of California campus in Irvine, streaming on the web at kuci.org and always available via podcast. We are on iTunes, we're on Stitcher, we're on other podcast platforms. Somebody reminded me the other day to let you know that you need to resubscribe. If you were an old subscriber to our iTunes podcast, we've kind of fallen off your radar. We had to kind of redo that. So definitely go back on, resubscribe, and you will get updates. Somebody told me the other day they weren't getting updates, but look for us under Writers on Writing. I'm your host for the hour, Marie Stone. We are doing what we do each and every Wednesday morning, which is chat with authors about their books, their process, their craft, how they're working and focusing and thinking during these interesting days. We return to one of my favorite forms, the short story, and even better, the unsettling short story. Susan Buttonweiser teaches creative writing in New York City public schools and to incarcerated women. Her writing has been nominated for a Pushcart Prize and appeared in Epiphany, The Atticus Review, Fail Better, and several other publications. She contributes news features to Women's Media Center and has been awarded several fiction fellowships from the Virginia Center of the Creative Arts. We Were Lucky with the Rain is her first collection. It's published by Four Wave Books, and it will drive our discussion today. Susan, welcome.
Thank you so much.
So before we dive into the collection, I'd just love to have you walk us through your sort of writing journey, because it sounds like writing has always been a part of your life. And I know your sister, who's been on the show in the past, is also a writer. So maybe it was just in the family genetics, but I kind of just like to hear your writing story. It sounds like you've been writing a long time.
Yeah, I've been writing since college. I mean, this book was a long time coming. I started taking writing classes when I was in college, and I really fell in love with the short story form. This was in the 1980s. So I think it was, in some ways, there was so much, you know, there's a lot of excitement around short stories, especially the contemporary short story, and, you know, like Raymond Carver and Mary Gateskill. And so I just had always had this dream of writing a short story collection. And I worked in journalism for a while, for 10 years. So that kind of, you know, when I was first out of college, so the dream of publishing a short story collection kind of fell by the wayside. And after September 11th, I sort of vowed to make writing more part of my life. But I also had two daughters and I was teaching. And so I was trying to make it the central part of my life, but I had all these other things going on as well. And then several years ago, I had this one year where I went to 4 funerals in 1 year, and 2 were for people around my age. And one in particular was my oldest friend, really. And so after coming home from his funeral, I sort of took a really hard look at my life and my writing and, you know, really sat down and just really, I mean, I really looked at this collection. But the reason why it wasn't getting published was it wasn't good enough yet.
I like this idea that you had sort of a, you know, come to God moment about your writing and taking it seriously and you know, the brevity of time and all of our mortality and all of that stuff. Because yeah. I think that's one of the biggest challenges for writers, I think, is I've got time, you know, there's no deadline on this and life goes on and, you know, it'll wait till tomorrow. And yeah, I really hear you on that, you know, that at some point you have to take your own work seriously and you have to take yourself seriously to get it done, because nobody else is going to, you know, it's not like work where there's a deadline, right?
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, no one will care if I don't write fiction, really, you know what I mean? And there's a lot of rejection involved with writing and making art, and it can be really hard to stay the course through all that. I mean, at least that was my experience. There was, you know, a lot of rejection along the way, and it takes a lot to try to steer the course. And definitely I, you know, had times where I would give up on projects and start new ones. I mean, I've written 2 unpublished novels as well in the time that I wrote this book. So, you know, I was very much starting and stopping projects and, you know, overwhelmed by the rejection and cheating on whatever project I was working on and starting another one and that type of thing. So, yeah, I mean, I think you know, I think what I came to it with these stories was that it was sort of like, this is what I've always wanted to do. And I hadn't given the collection everything that I had. I sort of felt like, even if I never published, I was like, I just felt like I want to give this everything I have. And then, you know, then I can put it to bed. So, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
At least I could say to myself, I have no more to give to this, to these stories. And that's sort of what I went with.
Well, take us into the collection. It sounds like it has been written over kind of a longer period of time, that the some of these stories sound like they started, I don't know how far back.
Some of them are from, I guess, sort of the early 2000s. And then some of them are more recent. And then I had, in an early version of this collection, I had other stories. You know, when I sat down and looked at it, I had to really think about what made the collection rather than just putting together every story I'd written. You know, I had to sort of not only this, like, what were the stronger stories, but what worked together. And even some stories that have been published just didn't fit in with this or were so old, I didn't have a connection to them anymore, even ones that have been published. So yeah, I had to sort of like sit down and, you know, think about what how these fit together. And if there's, I mean, there's not really a theme with them, but just some sort of driving mood or something with all of the stories.
I would definitely say there's a driving mood with these stories. Yeah.
Yeah. So it was like, you want to, I guess with anything, you sort of think, oh, I should put everything that I've ever written in this. And it was kind of hard to just be like, okay, this story that I wrote and worked on is not going to be in this. It is done, you know?
So take me a little bit into the, you say there isn't a unifying theme, but I do feel like there kind of is. So take me into kind of what the, you know, as you look across the arc of everything, maybe everything you've done in this collection, kind of the things that keep haunting you, the things that, you know, you keep turning back to. And then I'll tell you what I saw.
Okay, yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, I guess what I meant was it wasn't like they're connected stories or, you know, they're all, I don't know, some short story collections are, you know, not connected, but some seem very connected, either like literally connected to each other or there's some driving theme. But I guess I'm really interested in, I mean, the themes that I feel like are sort of emotional isolation and family fragmentation and economic fragility. Those are all things that really interest me, both in fiction and in nonfiction. And I'm really drawn to them. And yeah, I just felt like I wanted the stories that I chose to, you know, I felt like this idea of putting together an album, like you want to have the sort of the beginning, a middle, and the end type of feeling, and that there's somehow, you know, I felt like the first story, Translucent Ghost, and the last story, Swan Lake, are like connected with each other, kind of, especially.
Yeah. Right. It's so funny how many writers of short story collections liken them to an album. It's an enduring theme.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I can see that. It's interesting because I kind of thought the DNA of this collection was embedded in this story kind of in the middle. It's called Nights at Marco Polo. It's this great story about a young man who works as a hotel, you know, housekeeper at this rundown, gritty motor lodge. And there's a line in there after his mother observes that the whole family is just kind of a bunch of underachievers. And it says, even the smaller stars make up the galaxy, are part of a luminous body, an essential contribution to the nighttime sky. And that kind of seemed like what the, you know, the collection hung on, were, you know, these smaller lives, quiet lives, but as essential to, you know, the makeup of what makes up our universe as any other. And I think that's the beauty of the short story form, is it pays attention to those smaller stars in the night sky. You know, some of the novels are a little cinematic, you know, big bright planets, but the short stories I do feel like are not the quiet background per se, but just like the little unexamined lives that you get to zero in on moments. And I just thought that was
beautiful. Oh, thank you. And I mean, that really, really has always interested me, that, you know, in all of my work, I mean, in writing and in teaching and just, you know, the voices and stories of people that we're not hearing about, that always interests me.
And the other thing that we're told a lot is to write what makes you scared. And a lot of these stories had, you know, a lot of temporarily missing children or children who aren't being adequately supervised. I mean, it had a very 1980s pre-helicopter parenting feel to it. Those were the years I grew up in, and it sounds like the years you grew up too. But just this kind of underlying feeling that there are all these kind of wild wolves out there who weren't being properly protected by their parents. And I don't know if that mental landscape keeps returning back to the years when you grew up. I find that's true for, well, it's true for me. It's true for a lot of writers that we're kind of trapped in our own childhood stuff, but it had that 1980s, 70s feel to it.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I actually grew up in the 70s, but I was thinking of these stories to be set in the sort of 2000s, but I think some of the families, what's happening with the parents overwhelms their ability to parent, you know, in the way that, I mean, that they're, whatever's going on with them, they all love their children, but their circumstances are such that they aren't really able to give their children what their children need. And because their children are children and you don't really have the vocabulary, the children know that they're not getting something, but they can't quite identify it either. Right. Or, you know, and they can't, you know, you can't really ask for it as a child, but you can't even really quite know it yet until you're older, I don't think.
Yeah, I really think the point of view of a child's point of view in stories is a really interesting one, because you're right, you're kind of trapped in that, you know, the reader understands what's going on and the child doesn't quite. And so you're in that murky, I can't articulate the emotions I'm experiencing, but the reader knows what's going on and the parents know what's going on. And so it's a really, I think, rich point of view to mine in short stories, because, you know, it takes you back to that time when you too could identify as a reader what it was like to not have the vocabulary for what you're going through.
I teach in like K through 12, but I keep getting placed in middle school. And I definitely feel like that age is so interesting. They're able to reflect on their life in a way that when you're younger, you kind of can't. I feel like it's such a great age to be a narrator for a short story, because you have some information, but you don't have all of the information, but you definitely have emotion and mood, which I don't know, it feels like that really connects with what the short story, but you can't explain, you know, you don't know everything that's really happening. You have like pieces of information and fragments of, almost like fragments of scene that are making up your narrative at the time. And I also feel like that that's such a resonant time in my life, being in middle school in particular. So I feel like I keep being drawn to having my main character be of middle school age. And I also, because I teach that age, I feel like I really know the difference between 11, 12 and 13. Like those are very different ages.
Well, let's break some of these stories apart. Hopefully we won't give too much away, but you know, this will be the disclaimer to our listeners that there might be some secrets given away. Was there, let's start with a story that may have given you a particular trouble, and we'll just walk through it of how you first conceived of it and how it changed over time with your revision process, so we can kind of dissect how a story is put together. I know you worked with, you worked with Will Allison and Patrick Ryan at One Story, it sounds like. And I'm curious, you know, if they were informing some of these along the way. They have these wonderful workshops. I just finished one of their short story ending workshops. And
I took that too.
They're great. I mean, it was great.
Yeah.
I just think even if you've been writing for a long time, there's a lot of good reminders in there of the many ways you can end a short story. So anyway, you know, if they informed you along the way, it'd be interesting to hear that too. So is there a story in here that was rough?
Yes.
Was there a story that wasn't rough on you?
No. And I also can't say enough good things about Will Allison and Patrick Ryan. They're both amazing. I mean, I've taken classes in person and online with Patrick Ryan, and he's amazing. And Will Allison gave me incredible feedback on this whole collection, which just changed not only the collection, but he gave me so much information about writing and revision and what makes a story. This small good feeling, I mean, I kind of started, and this is the way I often start stories, is I have an image. It's about a 12-year-old boy who is on a trip to England, and his father's brought him along reluctantly, which becomes clear as it goes along. But and it's right before Christmas too, so that the son is with his father, his parents are divorced, and they haven't spent Christmas together since, you know, in several years. And so I saw actually a boy when I was in England buying cigarettes at midnight, and I was in a restaurant, and he was bringing them back to a man in a suit who's with another man in a suit. And I just sort of felt like I started imagining that this was on a work trip with his father. And I just imagined this whole thing from there. It seemed like I kind of quickly got that he was on this, and then I sort of translated into the story after seeing this scene in my head, this actual real scene. And the scene of the boy buying cigarettes actually didn't make it into the story, but it gave me the kernel to start with. And I had him on the work trip. I knew his family situation, and it kind of kept like, I couldn't, all I had was really the beginning for a really long time. And then I kind of could move him a little bit further and further. It took me, usually I sort of can, like, I maybe will rush to the end of a story and go back and fill it in. But this one, I still couldn't quite figure out what was actually going on. They go to Brighton, and there was a real thing happened where this old pier in Brighton fell apart, and it was in the news. It's like this famous old pier that was decrepit, and it had fallen apart, and it was a big deal, and all the wood was washing up on the shore. And when I saw that, I've been like really struggling with the story, and I saw that in the news, and that seemed like somehow a good way to end the story. I hope that doesn't give too much away, but it's still like, even when I had this sort of bones of it, and it took a while to, I really had to keep going back and filling it out and spending time with the boy in my head. And I also think it was like slightly too sledgehammery, sad, you know. I feel like I think I used, when I, in my earlier days of writing, it was just sort of relentlessly sad. And then I think that in the end you feel nothing, you know what I mean? So I felt like I needed to really love his parents too. And that kind of took a while. Like, I was sort of giving them humanity too. And I really have tried to do that in all of my stories, is not have these sort of cartoon, you know, these horrible parents and these poor children. And it's so much more nuanced than that. And I think that always makes a more interesting story. Even if like the mother in the story isn't in it for very long, but I really felt for her so much, and the father too. And I guess it just took me a while to get there. And again, like, even once I had a bone, it took me a long time to get to where it is right now.
It's so great. I don't know if the peer at the end was sort of a subconscious. I mean, I think it's really interesting when the subconscious can do a lot of the work for the writer. And that strikes me as one of those cases that could be, that you would see that, or you experience it however it happened, and understand in a murky emotional level that is a perfect metaphor for kind of what was going on in these characters' lives. And the other thing I wanted to point out about this age group of point of view from a middle school, early adolescent point of view, is the kids are also coming to grips with their own sexuality. And that was a enduring theme through a lot of these kids who are just starting to uncover their own sexual selves while their parents are going through their stuff. And so that conversation between what sexual inclination looks like in early adolescence versus what it looks like in middle age, that kind of conversation in these stories, I thought was really great. So it's hard, and it's hard to know how to get into a story, right? I think that's that's one of the hardest things, getting in and getting out in a short story. You know, in a novel, you only have to do it once, and in a short story, you have to do it 12 times. So it's really, I think, tricky to know where a story begins. This story begins in dialogue. And that can work really well. I think it's a tricky way to work, but the nice thing about it is you're already in the action. You know, somebody's already taking the initiative to talk to somebody. So I do kind of like stories that start in dialogue where you're already mid conversation, and, you know, the father's trying to convince the son that, you know, this is going to be a great thing.
Right.
I know it's impossible to say how many drafts a story went through. Is that how you do it? You kind of get the bones down and then rewrite, or is it just constant decisions as you're doing it on a sentence by sentence level?
I'd say the first thing is just trying to get it to be something. I feel like I can't remember some teacher I had, maybe it was John Reed, said, first there's the zero draft. It's not even a rough draft. So I feel like that, to me, in some ways, that's one of the hardest parts, is just getting the zero draft. So it's like it's something that you can work with. And then, of course, I guess the next part, I mean, the revising, where you're going in and like really working the sentences, that part is really, really, I love that part. The zero draft is really hard, and the kind of making it so you're like, okay, this, and the ending, and I mean, just the shaping of it so that it actually is truly a story is also incredibly hard. But the sort of carving and sculpting, I love that part so much. I have no idea how many drafts of this small good feeling. I mean, so many. And then also just, yeah, I couldn't say. I mean, and I've worked on this one. This has been off and on. This is an old story as well. I wrote this a while ago. So yeah, that's so an embarrassing number of drafts went into this long feeling.
You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. My guest this morning is Susan Buttonweiser. The short story collection is We Were Lucky with the Rain. You brought up the idea of story structure, and I think that's really interesting. I was just talking with Jess Walter, was talking about he has to see a story in a sort of, or a novel in a sort of structure, in a physical, visual way. And I was looking at a lot of these stories through that lens, and I was thinking, you know, like, Swan Lake, which is the last story in the collection, you've got, I was picturing it sort of like this merry-go-round where you've got the pole in the center of the merry-go-round is these prisoners are on the loose, they've escaped. Mm-hmm. Then each individual story that goes around it, or, you know, kind of like the horses around it that are spinning around this central story structure, you know, the central problem in the middle. Other stories, you know, seem like gathering waves where you've got, you know, something brewing way out in the ocean. That's where the interesting bits are happening. And then, you know, as time goes on, as decades go on, you know, whatever happened out there in the distant past is what's causing the story to crash up on the shore. And I don't know if you look at story in sort of that way of trying to look at different story structures and narrative arcs and play with that at all, or if you've gotten instruction from teachers along the way about how to structure story, but they were all structured just slightly differently and in really interesting, nuanced ways. And I don't know if you can talk to that at all.
Yeah, I feel like till I die, I will be learning about what a story structure is and how to structure them. And I guess I don't, when I start off writing a story, I usually have, like I said, with the small good feeling, like I feel like I have an image or some sort of beginning. Occasionally I have like the whole thing, really rarely though, that the Last Supper, I sort of, again, read about a family where they were having their last meal before their last evening at home before their father was going to go to prison. And I was really drawn to that idea for a story. So that was sort of a rare time where I had the whole structure already. But usually and also Someone's Drunk Wife too, I sort of had that structure right away too. But it's more that I have this sort of beginning and I have to feel my way through. And when I wrote Swan Lake was one of the ones that I wrote really differently than all of the other stories. And I also, it's actually it's the most recent of the stories. And I was obsessed with, I'm really into the news and especially drawn to true crime. I've always been, since I was a kid, really drawn to that. But when the two men escaped from the prison in upstate New York, which is a true story, I was obsessed with that story. I was reading all of the local papers it happened in the northern Adirondacks, and I was reading all the local papers up there. And what was great about all the papers up there was there was so much more information about how it was impacting the people, you know, in the town. It wasn't just these two, it wasn't just the hunt. I feel like the rest of the country was sort of following the hunt for these two men, or at least I was following that. But in the local papers, there was all this information about, you know, there was a story about teenagers that, you know, that they had to cancel school one day. And there was literally a picture of, you know, all these teenagers went to the beach for the day, and, you know, a bar where they were kind of tracking the outbreak. And I sort of got really interested in how it was impacting all of the sort of just the people in the town. And I wrote, and I had a few characters from other, I had just sort of these characters floating around in my notebooks that I hadn't really, you know, I didn't really, like I had this upstate New York traffic violations lawyer that I had always wanted to do something with. And he suddenly seemed like he would be good. And he seemed like he now lived in this fictional town, Swan Lake. And so I just wrote all these sort of, I think your description of a merry-go-round is really good, but I wrote all these various people and how they were being impacted by it. And again, when I actually put I didn't really know what I was doing at all. I didn't really have a vision for it, except obviously there was the true story of what happened, which was the men were both, one was killed and one was caught. So that, like, the outside arc of the story was there, but for the characters, it wasn't, you know what I mean? And so I spent a long time writing just these various people, and I had to take some of them didn't really work. And then I kind of had to shape them all together to make it into an actual short story. But I had no idea what I was doing at all when I started it. It wasn't like, I knew I didn't want to just have one, you know, main character that are in most of my stories. So it took a long time, and I actually workshopped the story at one story workshop, which was incredibly helpful.
I was going to say, is there advice or whatever that you garnered from, it doesn't have to be one story in particular, but you know, the things that resonate. I mean, I love this idea of the zero draft. I've never heard that. I'm totally going to use that when I'm sitting down. I'm like, it's just a zero draft. It's okay. Calm down.
Yeah.
But I don't know if there are things that were said to you in some of those workshops, kind of an amorphous question, that kind of resonated where it shifted your thinking about how you would approach a story.
Yeah. I definitely think giving yourself permission to write the zero draft is huge. But then once you're going through it, I definitely think, and even when I was editing the stories with Martha Rhodes, the editor at Four Way Books, I mean, she was so helpful about like pointing out some of the stories, especially Distant Edge of the Horizon. There was a lot of extra characters and names, and she was sort of really good at helping to distill down to, you know, what is the core of the story and not have all this extra sort of noise. And I definitely feel like that's a problem I have, and that I'll have a lot of extra things because I'm seeing everything myself. And then you have to kind of, when you're editing it and revising it, you know, you have to kind of think, what is the information that's useful for this story? Like what's in service of the story, and what is maybe more of like an inside joke with yourself? You know what I mean? That needs to come out. And also sometimes collapsing characters. Sometimes there's three characters and actually they could just be one character, you know? So I guess just, I don't know if I have quite advice, but except for to give yourself permission to write the zero draft and to never give up, and it's never too late.
Yeah, that's helpful. I really like this idea of collapsing characters, because you're right. It's very easy to overpopulate a story. It's easy to have a lot of character names where the reader's like, who are we following and why are we following this person?
Yeah. You know, I took a workshop with Dan Sean, and he sort of had this thing where the writing part and editing part are almost like two people. You know, writing part is kind of a kid where you're like having everything. The parent is coming in and being like, who made the mess? It needs to be cleaned up. And you do have to kind of let go of, you know, you might have like spent so much time on some part of the story or whatever, or a character, and it's working. And I think that putting things aside as well is really helpful, even though, you know, you have this drive to finish. I think these stories, like I was saying, were written over a long period of time. And I think there's something to be said for putting things aside and looking at them again with a fresh eye.
Yeah, because I think you can almost trick yourself into being a non-emotional reader. You know, if enough time passes that somebody else wrote this and now I'm coming at it with, you know, a reader's eye instead of a writer's eye. Yeah, I totally agree with that. I'm glad you brought up The Distant Edge of the Horizon, because it was another example of a very interesting story structure that was different than some of the others. And I thought, you know, that one kind of felt like a braid. There were a couple of different storylines going on. It's about another adolescent girl who's coming to terms with her sexuality at the same time that her mother has passed and her father is, you know, potentially losing his job. And I really think it's interesting when stories have sort of a couple of different things going on that seem totally distinct from each other, but that bump up against each other in, you know, kind of subconscious. So there's a danger here and there's a danger here. And how are those two things interacting with each other? And that seems like a really good example of that, that there were two kind of seemingly unrelated things going on with this girl, but they were resonant in sort of a emotionally satisfying way for the reader. And I don't know how you came up with those two different things in conversation with each other, or if that was yet another setting it aside for a long time and seeing it anew.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely really early on, I just had, again, this image of this girl in a fishing boat with her dad and some sort of, it took me a while to realize it was her boss, but just sort of a man that she really, you know, really didn't like. And that was you know, and that it was early and, you know, with the fog. And then, you know, I kind of came to realize that she would somehow interact with kids from her school. That sort of all kind of happened organically without me thinking about, like, I guess I often feel like I'm following more like what feels true to the characters and the situation rather than I'm thinking, you know, about making metaphors or anything like that, if that makes any sense. And I think the thing that was like, there was so many people in that story. And again, I'd spent a long time, there's a whole scene in the beach and it was really distracting and I had to really cut back a lot on it. But again, that's an example I think of when you have to just be like, these are things that mean something to me. They do not work in the story whatsoever.
Those are the hardest.
Yeah, it's really hard.
So tell me a little bit about, a lot of these were sent out to literary journals and kind of that process of knowing when it's time to let something go out into the world and finding homes for some of the literary journals recommend along the way.
Well, things have changed so much, but I mean, yeah, it's hard. I mean, I think the thing is, it's sort of this feeling, at least for me, was when I felt like I really didn't have anything more to give to a story rather than, I mean, it's really scary to send your work out for a variety of reasons, especially if you're not filled with confidence to begin with. It's sort of this feeling of like, who do you think you are or whatever. But first, you want to find publications that you like their work. And then, you know, you want to find places that have a mix of emerging and more established writers. And then as I went along, I also wanted to look for places where there was maybe a possibility that they were submitting their stories into prizes, that they had stories that had won prizes, not necessarily for yourself, but you just sort of feel like you want to be, I guess, as you're building your career as a fiction writer, that you're in places, that you're trying to get into places that are kind of maybe more in the conversation or something. I don't know if that makes sense, but like, I had a story published in Fail Better and they did end up submitting it for a Pushcart Prize, not nominating it for a Pushcart Prize. So I guess that's the thing. I think as you're building your career as a fiction writer, I mean, it's great that there are so many online publications and, you know, prizes that are really just, you know, online prizes as well. I mean, there's, you know, Best of the Net. And I think to look for places that are ambitious, you know, the literary magazines that take emerging writers, but that also have ambition for their writers.
I sort of do a shotgun approach where I'm like, I'm just going to spray the world with this story. And it's not as strategic. I think this idea of being strategic about your placement is a really good one.
I was in this really great writing workshop. And one of the women I was with, Jody Weiner, who's a poet, she actually was the one who started, like, you know, sending stuff out. And I guess it kind of gave me permission to do it as well. I mean, it's so scary to start doing that.
It is,
But it's really scary. But she had this whole system and she was sort of like, it's numbers. Like you need to submit a lot. And a couple of years ago, I was at the Virginia Center for the Creative Arts and I was talking with some writers and someone was telling me about this thing called, I don't know if this is quite the title of it, but it was sort of like things where you try to get 100 rejections in 1 year.
Yes, so that's, I've done that. Yeah. Right.
Okay. Well, like that's the amount you're submitting, you know, that you're submitting a vast amount of work and that your goal is the 100 rejections rather than, oh, I'm going to get 5, you know, pieces published this year or whatever. I thought that was really helpful. That was a really good way to look at it.
Yeah, we've had that conversation a lot that, you know, somebody will say, well, I sent it out 25 times. I'm like, well, that's not nearly enough. You really haven't started yet.
Yeah. So,
you know, and a lot of people are surprised to hear that. But you're right. It's a numbers game. And once you... I think you're right. Once you feel like I've taken this as far as it can go, then it's just a matter of, a lot of sending it out and to not be afraid of rejection. I mean, to just say, oh, good. I have another number to add to my 100 wall. That's great. You know,
right.
So tell me about Four-Way Books, because I'm also loving small presses right now and the things that they can do for writers. And tell me about finding them and working with them and kind of the scope of what they publish.
Four-Way Books, I can't say enough good things about Four-Way Books. They're amazing. Martha Rhodes is incredible, a really amazing editor, and everyone on the staff there is just incredible, really, really talented and really kind. It's such a warm press. And that's, I guess I just felt like when it did get accepted, it felt like all roads were leading to Four-Way Books. And I was just so grateful that everything happened the way that it did. And I just put a poem for the stories. I looked for, when I was submitting the collection, I mean, a lot of small presses are really great, except many presses are poetry presses only. And Four Way is one of the few small presses that has a wide, you know, like is mostly poetry, but that also accepts short fiction. And they have an open reading period every June for both poetry and fiction for the whole month of June. And I submitted to their open reading period and it got accepted that way. But a lot of small presses also run contests. And I think for someone like me who doesn't have an agent and is not coming out of an MFA program and is like I'm not really connected into anything and I'm sort of submitting just on my own, I felt like the small presses or a contest were possibilities for me. But just this year, Tommy Blount, his Fantasia for The Man in Blue has been awarded for a national, he's a finalist for a National Book Award. And several writers have been awarded New York Foundation for the Arts Fellowships. We just awarded this fall. And it's just like in a really strong group of poets and writers. So I'm really, really honored to be on their list.
I love talking about these paths for people who don't necessarily have MFAs or don't have agents, that you don't have to despair. You know, there are other ways into the writing world beyond the traditional path. Yeah, it sounds like you have a very rich and alive writing community that you've taken a lot of classes and workshops through One Story. Yeah. And then I know it sounds like you also have a kind of a regular writing group that you are in contact with. And I like to talk about this idea of writing communities because it's such a lonely profession. And tell me a little bit about finding your tribe in the writing world.
Yeah. Well, actually, I'm not in a writing group anymore, but I was first. The really early drafts of these stories were a lot of them were written when I was in this writing group that I was in when my daughters were very young. And we met each other through, we'd all taken classes at like a night writing school called the Writer's Studio, which is in New York City. And we all sort of found each other through that. And that was incredibly helpful. Like I said, one of the writers in it, she was also applied to and got into McDowell and Virginia Center for the Creative Arts, and I think really inspired me to really try go for these things and to submit my work. And also we were really serious and we met regularly, and it was, I mean, I think having the deadline of a write, you know, when you meet people, and also I think for me, having the shame that someone's going to read something, you know, I think would make me work really hard before I sent it to them. Cause I don't really want someone else to read the zero draft so much. I want to push myself harder. So it's not just, you know, a blob of words. So it's really, really hard. I think without, at least for me, having that writing group was incredible, and taking classes. And there's so many amazing classes, like you were saying, One Story, a Public Space. I mean, there's just so many places that have great courses that you can take even online, and summer writing conferences, all those things are so helpful, especially again, for someone like me who was just sort of without an agent and without not having an MFA or doing an MFA or something like that.
You're in a good spot. New York is a good spot, I think, for all of this. I mean, but you're right. There are a lot of online courses, well, especially now in the pandemic, there's a lot of online courses, but there's a lot of opportunity. Those summer programs, I think, are great. You know, the Sewanee and Red Loaf and Tin House are really, and a great place to meet agents as well. I think a lot of those, Squaw Valley here in California is a great place to make, contacts if you are looking for an agent. So drawing down on our time, but are there last minute, is there more advice that you've gotten along the way?
I just want to also shout out to Linda Berry, who I had, I went to the Indiana Writers Conference several years ago, and she and Dan Shawn were both teaching there, and her work on creativity, and I mean, she's a graphic artist and cartoonist, and she's also a writer, but some of her work that she's doing now is around, you know, drawing, but I found her work incredibly, incredibly helpful, especially 100 Demons. And she has this thing called the 5-Minute Diary, which I found online. I think just this way to, she sort of had this whole thing about the way to start and writing with a pen and a pencil and paper when you're writing, first of all, rather than on your computer or on your phone or however people write. And to try to stick with this, you know, the way when we're children, everyone draws and writes and whatever, and you don't really think about the professional part of it at all. And it's only when you're older, you know, like how many of us who aren't artists draw as adults, not, you know what I mean? But when it's most children, if you crayon and a piece of paper in front of them, they'll just draw something. And then they're like, wait, no, I can't do this. And she was really good at trying to, her whole practice is more about getting back in touch with that and devices for just trying to get all that out of your head that you cannot do this. And the, like I was saying about writing with a pen and pencil and just things like that. And her work is really incredible. I just think everything, I mean, a lot of my teaching is when I'm teaching with incarcerated women and in schools too, just this idea that I really want to give to my students is like, you are allowed to do this. You are allowed to write, you know, you're allowed, what you have to say is important. And I feel like she's really, I think, trying to put that forward too. I think for myself and for my students, I feel like it's really hard for many people to just feel like it's okay to create and to put what you think and feel out into the world.
I like that. Yeah. I think a lot of people don't feel like they either have the permission or it's too much time. They should be doing something else. Or yeah, you're right. Getting over that hump of I have the authority and permission to be creative and to put stuff out there. I think that's a huge hurdle. It is a huge hurdle for a lot of people. So is it books that you would access for her, or it's a website, or?
Yeah, she has this book called What It Is, which is really, really great. And then one called Picture This. And also, if I can just say one more thing about working with incarcerated women. I mean, I think, you know, a lot of people, I think, are told their whole life that they're not important and that, you know, that what they have to say doesn't matter at all. And it's always when I'm teaching with incarcerated women, it's always so moving when they write something and it affects everybody, you know, and that they're able to put a voice to what's going on with them.
I talk to a lot of writers who work with incarcerated women, and the stories, Wally Lamb is sort of the notable one.
Yeah.
The stories that come out of women's prisons are incredible. I mean, talk about women who should have authority to tell their stories. They're always incredible. How did you get involved with that?
I was doing that. I got involved with that about 12 years ago, actually through a colleague from my writing workshop. She had a connection, a professional connection to a maximum security prison. And we started doing writing workshops through that. And it's just been just the most incredible work. I'm really, really grateful to have been able to do that.
It's such an important thing, I think, to give the voiceless a voice or to give them, you know, permission to speak, I think is just really great. Susan Buttonweiser, this was so fun. You have a website, which I think is your name. Yeah, SusanButtonweiser.com.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
There's stories up there. There's information about how you can get your hands on this great collection. I think there's some other interviews up on there. So it's a really great site. I highly encourage people to visit you there. And thanks so much for taking the time. This was wonderful.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
That's all the time we have for today. We will be right back here with you next Wednesday morning. So until next time, thanks so much for joining us. Have a great day.